So we were talking yesterday about the quantum Zeno effect. So remember, we consider a system which is prepared in some initial state, call it zero. Then we let it evolve. For a very short time, delta t. And that's the new state. And then we make a measurement that projects onto the original state. And we calculated what the probability is that that you get a positive result for this measurement. And we saw that equal to this expression, where there are some higher order terms. But if delta t is sufficiently small, then you can just look at these first two terms. And the key thing is that you get this delta t squared dependence. So if you contrast that with the classical kind of situation, so the probability, for example, if you look at exponential decay, which is something that you can calculate using classical reasoning, then the probability after some small time that the system has decayed goes as e to the delta t over tau. And if you expand that, you get a linear expression. You get a linear term. Whereas here, you don't have a linear term. So clearly, it's different. So if we go back to the quantum case over here, and now imagine that every delta t, you make a measurement, a strong measurement, to see if the system is in its original state or not. You see, so every delta t, we do that. We want to see what the state of the system is after some time, big T. Okay. So that means that we're going to make big T over delta T measurements. Okay. So the probability the system is seen to be in the state zero after all of these measurements is just given by this expression to the power of the number of times that you look. So this is the probability that after every measurement you find it in the zero state. Okay. Now, if you expand this out using a standard expansion, then you get 1 minus k squared delta t squared t over delta t. So using a Taylor expansion, then you get that. So I'm just expanding out this bracket. And you can see that's equal to 1 minus k squared t delta t. So so here the important point is that as you let delta t tend to zero, the probability of seeing it, of it not decaying, tends to one. So if you keep looking to see where the system is, it never decays. It never changes from its original state. It's called the quantum Zeno effect because of sort of similar, is it similar to sort of Zeno-type paradoxes? Sometimes called the quantum watched pot effect. If you keep looking, then the pot never boils. And you can see it depends crucially on having delta t squared here, because that way, when you divide by this delta t, you still have a delta t left over. Now, if you were to do the same thing for the a classical case, you have delta t here, you substitute that into here, then you'd get cancellation, so you wouldn't get this result. You wouldn't get that this goes to zero. You'd have some actual finite decay rate. Okay. And this kind of makes sense. So in the classical case, if you keep looking at a system, well, looking at the system doesn't disturb it, so it wouldn't affect its decay rate. It just decays as it was going to. Whereas in the quantum case, if you keep looking at a system, you're actually disturbing the system. And as a consequence, you can stop it from decaying. So have you done the tutorial yet with the Elitzer-Weidman-Bohm problem? And did you use a quantum Zeno type? There's a more complicated example in that tutorial. Did you look at that? Yeah. Did you look at that? So that's an example of using the quantum Zeno effect to do Bohm testing. So the effect there is exactly the same as this effect. Any questions on this? No. Okay. So it's interesting to think about why we see the quantum Zeno effect in quantum theory, and it's related to the fact that you have evolution for pure states, which is linear in the Hilbert space. So quantum theory has this remarkable property that even when you have a finite number of distinguishable states, even when you have finite information carrying capacity for your system, you can still have continuous evolution. So let me explain what I mean by that. Imagine you have a classical system, like a classical system that can have three distinct states, 1, 2, and 3. Then you can have probabilities for each of the states. And now the sum of these three probabilities adds up to one. And that means that if you represent your state by a list of probabilities, then we know that these three probabilities have to lie somewhere on this triangle. In general, you get a if you have a the general number of some arbitrary number of distinguishable states, then you have a simplex, so-called classical probability simplex. And then these points here are the extremal states, and they correspond to pure states. That's where the system is definitely in one of the three states that we're looking at. So for example, if this was a ball that could be in one of three boxes, then this would correspond to it definitely being in box one. Okay. In the quantum case, on the other hand, the situation is quite different. So look, let's consider a qubit. So this is the density matrix for a qubit. So this is where you have spin up and spin down along the z direction on the diagonal. You can show that A is equal to This isn't right. Sorry, that should be your. So if you calculate what A is equal to, then you get an expression which is linear in four probabilities, PZ up, PZ down, PX up, and PY up, with complex coefficients. And so what that means is that there's the same information in here as there is in here. In fact, this expression is linearly related to this expression. So this is a perfectly good way of representing the state also in terms of form. Is the row, sorry?
Row, the density matrix, represent the most general density matrix?
For a qubit, yeah, for a spin half particle, yes.
But why is the A depends on PZ? Like, I thought the A is of diagonal, so
it depends on the X. There's a mistake there, it should be. So the A also depends on the overall normalization. So if we impose that PZ plus and PZ minus, plus, if you impose that this number plus this number is equal to 1, then you just see dependence on X and Y. But clearly, if you scale this thing down, then it affects A as well. So the value of A is proportional to the, or is related to the total, the normalization. If you do the calculation, this is what you get. So it's really just a matter of calculation.
This is a density matrix.
Say again, sorry.
This is a density matrix.
Well, okay. So I think we talked about whether you should normalize states or not. If you don't normalize states, then there's some important information in there that you can use to calculate joint probabilities. So it's not really necessary to normalize them. However, if you choose to normalize them, then certainly the sum of these two is equal to 1. My feeling is that by not normalizing them, you see better what the sort of structure is here, because this thing is now given by this list of probabilities. But if you do choose to normalize them, like so, then you have only 3 degrees of freedom here, And now you can ask what is the shape of allowed states? You know, over here, we saw that the shape of allowed states is given by this. So what about over here? So let me just draw. So this is a slightly different diagram because I'm going to omit the z minus degree of freedom because I can't draw a picture in four dimensions. Okay, so clearly for normalized states, we can plot all the allowed states into that space. Does anyone have any idea what the shape of allowed states is? Sorry? Yeah, that's right, yeah. Do you know why, or roughly, can you give a rough justification? Right, yeah. So it's just, so if you've done the block sphere, all we've done here is just we've sort of reparametrized, this is a linear reparametrization to different coordinates, but the same coordinates. So to be more precise, what you can do is you can draw a unit cube. So I'll try to draw a unit cube. So there's a cube. Unit cube, and then inside this cube, so this is one, you place a sphere that touches all six sides of the cube. So there's a sphere. So in the middle of each face of this cube, the sphere touches. And the allowed states are the states on or in that, on or in that sphere. And in particular, the pure states correspond to points on the surface. Mixed states correspond to points in the interior. So it's really just a matter of calculation to deduce that from this. It's interesting. So here I'm just giving you the case for a qubit. If you have a qutrit, then the space is not so simple anymore. It's no longer just a sphere, but it's a more complicated structure, and we may talk about that later if we have time. But anyway, actually, are there any questions on this? It's just simple.
Can you elaborate more on how did you get sphere touching the six sides?
So you start with this, and you calculate these probabilities. I think I'd have to sit down and do a calculation. Maybe we can see afterwards. You start with this. You've got these numbers in here, effectively three numbers. And you can see that you get, if you constrain to the pure states, for example, which are the ones that have rho squared equal to 1, then you can see that forces you to have a you constrain to a sphere. It's just a matter of calculation. It just takes 10 minutes. So the pure states have. If you use that, you'll get the sphere. And then you know that the other states are just mixtures of those.
Should that be rho squared equals rho?
Yes. Sorry. Equals rho. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so you can see, if you think about the quantum Zeno effect, if you're in the classical case over here, you're on one of these vertexes, then you kind of have to jump to the other pure states. So you can write down transition probabilities, but these transition probabilities are going to be, you know, the most natural thing would be to make them proportional to the time you allow for the jump, for for small times. So you're going to get a linear dependence on delta t. Whereas over here, you can have two states which are very close to each other on the surface, and you can imagine that the evolution of some small time delta t just leads to a nearby pure state on the surface. And so you can have this kind of Zeno type effect. There's another interesting thing here. Even if you look at the case where you have a continuous space, so take the classical case where you have a particle that can be anywhere along this line. Imagine the particle is here, and you want to get it to go to here. Well, there is a continuous path which goes all the way through here, through these points in between. So, you know, if you want to have continuous evolution from here to here, then the system has to evolve continuously through these points in between. If you take the classical case, so if you take the quantum case on the other hand, and if you have two places, you can write down a state that looks like this. So you could imagine starting in the state x1 and then slowly decrease the amplitude in front of this while increasing the amplitude in front of the x2 term. And so you would evolve from being here to being here in a continuous fashion, but at no point is the state at any of the locations in between. So this is admitted in the state space, in the kinematics. It's not something that is typically allowed by quantum dynamics because Hamiltonians are local. But at least in the state space, you can imagine, you know, a bit like Scotty, sort of beaming, you know, just disappearing from here and reappearing here in a continuous fashion. So it's a curious difference between the two cases. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's because it's there in the state space. It's relevant. But you're right. It's not actually something that that physically will happen typically.
What should I?
Why should you care? Sorry. Well, I mean, to me, it just seems curious that there is at least in the state space a continuous path between these two points, even though it's not there in the classical case, and this seems to be a difference. I mean, in physical theories, it's the kinematics is interesting by itself before you consider what the particular dynamics that you impose. I mean, in principle, you could write down non-local Hamiltonians that would do this, even though physics seems to rule them out. Okay. So I want to move on to a new topic. Which is, I'm going to look at, so you remember we're interested in sort of different novel quantum effects, and one rich source of novel quantum effects is quantum optics. There's lots of experiments, and you can do very simple experiments there. Some very interesting stuff happens. Aggie, who's not here today, she's more of an expert on quantum optics than I am. So let me let me just go through the basics. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at quantum optical interferometers. So I'm going to go through in a similar way to the way I did before how to do calculations for quantum optical interferometers. To keep it simple, all these calculations are going to be single mode. So we assume we're just looking at a single, each path we consider will have a single well-defined momentum. And also, we're going to take all the polarizations to be the same. Imagine the photons all have, say, vertical polarization. And the trick is to use creation and annihilation operators. So these have certain properties. So if you have a certain mode, the modes are labeled by the letter, the same letter that you use to represent the creation or annihilation operator, so A, B, C, etc. And if you have a certain mode that has n photons in it, and you hit it with a creation with an annihilation operator, then you get this. So you take one photon out of the mode and you multiply by the square root of n. Because n minus 1 is not defined, if n is equal to 0, you also have that property. And then creation operators, so annihilation operators take a photon out of the mode. Creation operators put a photon into the mode. Like so. And you can show that it follows from these facts that you get these commutation relations. Any questions at this point? Straightforward. Good. So, now we can look at some basic elements that you might use in a quantum optical experiment. So a mirror. You can treat a mirror just by putting an eye in front, like we did before. A path length. Just multiply by the appropriate phase factor, and similarly for a phase shifter. For a beam splitter, this is a You have two paths coming in, two paths coming out. And you can choose these equations. So these are all very similar, of course, to what I showed you before for just ordinary interferometers, single particle interferometers. And like so. And you can use this to calculate the way a state changes as it passes through one of these elements, or any number of these elements. And they all induce a unitary transformation on the state. I'll explain what I mean by that in just a minute. Which one? This one?
If the path length is an integer multiple of width, then it has to be the base.
I think it's right like that. So if lambda is after if you increase the path length by a full wavelength, then you return to the same phase. You're right. E to the I. Yeah, you're right. We need a 2 pi here. Good point. Yeah. I think I may have made that mistake on Monday as well. I did. Thanks. So obviously I meant that to be in units of 2 pi. Thanks. Okay, so here's an example. If you take some state like this, and you're going to let it impose on a beam splitter, let it impinge on a beam splitter, then, first of all, you can replace these expressions with expressions in terms of the creation operators. So if you look at the expressions there, then clearly, if you act on the vacuum for the M mode, m times, then you're going to get m photons in here, and then you have to divide by an appropriate normalization factor. And similarly for the b side. And now we can evolve that through. And so we have to replace each of these by the new operator. We get that. Yeah. There's one clarification here. Really, what I should have written here was just a zero for this, so the vacuum state. So instead of this, I should have put a zero here. And then you can think of this as just being the vacuum state over all modes, so the sort of tensor product over all modes. Let's call it all modes I. So then, if we hit the vacuum state over all modes with something which only creates photons in the A and B modes, then we get back to what we had here. And then likewise, really, I should put a zero here. But then this has got C and D modes in it, so it's going to create photons in the C and D ones. So the notation is a bit bad here, but I think it just makes life easier if we don't have to keep using this expression all the time. And you know, I suppose over here, strictly speaking, we should have had the vacuum in all modes except A and B. You know, so this is okay. How are we doing for time? Good. Oh, one interesting question here is how to prove that this transformation is actually unitary. So so at the top, when we defined a beam splitter, we chose, or wherever it was here, we chose a unitary transformation creation modes. But it's not immediately obvious that if you plug that into an expression like this, you'll get a unitary transformation on the state itself. And I don't know a simple proof of that. It's the sort of fact that ought to be immediately obvious, but I don't see why it is. But you can. There was a complicated proof when I mentioned this a couple of years ago. One of the Psi students came up with a proof of that that took a few pages. So if anyone has a really simple proof, that would be good. Okay. One of the elements I perhaps should have included in my list of elements, the sort of Lego building blocks, is a detector. And what detectors measure is they measure, in principle at least, what they can measure is the photon number operator. Which is given by multiplying together the annihilation and creation operators. So that you'd have something like that. Okay. There's a few more complicated building blocks. So there's some interesting sources. So a laser produces a state, and theorists usually take the state produced by a laser to be a coherent state. And they're defined by this equation. They are basically eigenstates. They are eigenstates of the annihilation operator with eigenvalue equal to this alpha. It's basically alpha, the bigger alpha is, the stronger. The bigger the magnitude of alpha is, the stronger the field, the beam. And then there's some phase information in here as well, because alpha can be complex. And you can calculate from here what alpha looks like if you want to write it down as a superposition of different number states. And it looks just like this. So if the intensity is very low, then the vacuum contribution is especially big. These coherent states are, in some senses, they're very classical. And they have an interesting property at the beam splitter. Which is so if you send coherent states in on the two incoming modes of a beam splitter, then the state that comes out has the interesting property that does anyone know the interesting property of the state that comes out? Sorry? So if you send a squeeze state for an interferometer, or let me say what state with the interesting property is, and you can tell me if a squeeze state has the same property. I don't know that. Anyway, I'll write down the property. So the interesting property is that it's a product state coming out. And if you send a squeeze state for an for a beam splitter, do you know that it's a product state or not? I don't. I think it's not, but . See, that's why Aggie should have been here, because she would know the answer to that question. Oh, okay, I didn't give myself room to write this down. Tensor product with just as an aside, every time I write down something like this, that really means the tensor product. But I normally omit the tensor product symbol because it increases the amount of notation. But in this case, I put the tensor product symbol in because I had to break the line. Yeah, so a product state going in, a product state of coherent states going in leads to a product state of coherent states coming out. And I'm pretty sure that's not true for squeeze states, but and they're also coherent, yeah. So they're coherent states where the new parameter for the coherent state is given by. Now, with respect, well, now they're in this new, they're now in C and D, so they're now states in this new, in these two new modes. So this state here, let's just take this one, which is in C. It would have the property that C times alpha is just a complex number. It's not anything other than that. Times the same thing. Use the beta here. So if I act on this coherent state with the annihilation operator corresponding to this mode, then I get the same state with the eigenvalue. Given by the number inside here. So I haven't given you a proof of that. If you wanted to prove it, you could go through this kind of mathematics, or it's probably a simpler way of doing it. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, if you just use the fact that they commute, then you're just gonna do it at this level without having to. You can just, yeah, that's right. So there's a whole bunch of different experiments that are interesting. How much time do I have? 5 minutes. 10 minutes. One of them uses also this fact that C and D commute. So let me. So you want to prove this basically is what you're saying. Okay, so you write this down, you propagate it through the beam splitter using those equations, and then you have to check that you get the right state. It's a while since I've done the calculation, so I can't give you the exact it goes through. I think it's pretty straightforward. So let's see. Oops. So I wanted to do what's called the Hong-U-Mandel experiment. But first of all, I need to do something called parametric down conversion. So let me show how that works. Parametric down conversion. So I think I mentioned this a few days ago. The idea is you have a certain type of crystal, has particular properties. You pump it with a laser, so you send some coherent state in, and then you can pick out. What will happen is photons in this input beam will get down converted into pairs of photons, which come out at an angle. And actually, you get a whole range of different angles coming out. But the angles are correlated. So if you pick out a certain direction here, you can pick out the corresponding direction on the other side. And one of these is called the signal. And one of these is called the idler. And for our purposes, it doesn't really matter which is called which, although I understand there is some reason for those names. Now, you can write down what happens here. You can write the effect of what happens here just using an interaction Hamiltonian. And because this happens very quickly, you can really just look at the interaction Hamiltonian. And it looks like this. So you take so the term, the thing that we're interested in is you annihilate a photon in the source mode, so the laser mode coming in, and then you create a photon in each of the two outcoming modes. Okay. There's also a term that does the opposite. So the Hermitian conjugate will have A, B, S, dagger. But that doesn't play a physical role in the situation we're investigating. And then there's this property that the momenta, so the k vectors of the photons, are correlated. So that's what helps us to pick out the two corresponding directions. So what we have then, so then you can look at what happens to the state as it evolves through here. So the unitary evolution is given by this e to the minus I h I delta t h. And this is just the interaction Hamiltonian, but like I said, the whole thing happens so quickly that you can ignore the free evolution parts of that. Or if you want to do a more careful calculation, you can put them in. It doesn't really change what we see. Okay, so here's an experiment This can be experiment one. You have a laser. You let the laser beam impinge on a crystal. This is just meant to be an absorption block, so the laser photons get absorbed and don't end up messing up the rest of the experiment. And then you you have detectors over here. So what happens, the initial state is this. This evolves through the parametric down conversion crystal, and I can expand this out. And that's equal to well, the first term doesn't change anything. So most of the time, you just get nothing. The probability of a photon being down-converted is very small. But then there's some small chance that you'll get a photon. And if you look at this, what it's going to do is it'll take one photon out of the source and put two photons into the, put a photon in each of the two modes. But this is just the annihilation operator acting on the coherent state. So it just gives us a factor alpha. So we get we get that. This is the interesting term. So you can see this factor increases. So the more intense the laser beam is, the higher the probability is of producing a photon in each of the modes. Okay. And if this term is small, then we can ignore the higher order terms, because here I just I just approximated the Hamiltonian by the first few terms in the expansion. Okay, so what I'll do tomorrow is I'll show you what's called the Uhong-Mandel experiment, and that's where you you actually bring these two beams that come out here, you bring them back together on a beam splitter. And something interesting happens because you have this commutation relationship. I'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay.